came tonight, but I can't.
Remember when we agreed we were going to take some time off and do some serious thinking, and then we'd come back with our favorite revolving door?
I remember nothing of the sort.
Come on. Revolving doors are part of what makes America great, and to a lesser extent, Canada. Honestly. And I'm not just saying this to make points at the big door maker upstairs. I have to say the one at the Joseph Smith Memorial Building, that thing's a banger.
Okay, even if that were true, and I'm not convinced that it is, that still leaves one huge aching question. What in the absolute hell does this have to do with anything?
You, and Tay agrees with me on this one, need to calm down.
How dare you.
No one is prepared to get in the time machine with that kind of attitude, ma'am. Because we need to go back to Kirtland for a bit. There's been some, stuff happening.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Okay, Mr. Director of Revolving Door Operations, you talked a pretty big game right out the gate. So humor me, what are we talking about today?
Well, see, we talked about Kirtland a little. And it's like eating Rice Krispie Treats. It's something that I did a long time ago, but I've moved far beyond that.
Great. You're just pissing off the In-N-Out and Rice Krispie Treats demographics. This is Utah. This is where we're recording. It's your hometown. What are you doing?
Listen, I feel like that Venn diagram is just one solid, likely sad and angry circle, but we digress, however. The reason we need to go back to the sleepy hamlet of Kirtland is probably obvious to anyone who's even mildly hip to the current scene. Because, of course, Grandmother Temple in Kirtland passed from Community of Christ hands after many years to LDS hands.
So how many years are we talking?
Please refer to the aforementioned lyrics above. Getting there. Fine. Since you're so antsy, you're now in charge of the review. We all know the bookends. You've got your Joseph Smith at the beginning, and then the Community of Christ until just barely. But what's the middle part?
Kids, when a community loves each other very much, then a revelation commanding a temple is born.
Ew. TMI.
The time was June 1833. The building was a house of the Lord. They weren't sure exactly what that was, but it would be Mormonism's first big building. That much was sure. They put on their hard hats, hitched up their vintage drawers, and went to work. Using elements from famous buildings and design books, they built the thing. By early 1836, it was time to dedicate this building. This marked the period of active use of the Kirtland Temple. Dedication, washing and anointing, school offices, normal Sunday meetings, all of the above. For two glorious years, it was the physical manifestation of Mormonism's first golden age. Until that all came crashing down.
While the June 1833 revelation called for preaching and fasting and prayer, the reality was that the temple would soon see a lot of other things. Yelling and shoving and bowie knives, for example. And that's actually a pretty good metaphor for the next several decades. The Kirtland Temple would be one of the best expressions of the complexity left in the shattering of the Mormon people after Joseph Smith's death. You might even say it was a
revolving door.
Hey, geez, spoiler alert. Fine. Yes, it was definitely a revolving door.
Viva la revolución!
I feel like you're not using that right, but okay.
Not true. Martin Harris's middle name was Che, not widely known. Back to work, though.
These are the jokes people are paying for.
Oh, and they're paying, they're getting their money's worth, I would argue, too. As people might recall, Joseph Smith hightailed it out of Kirtland in January 1838, never to return. This, of course, meant that life in Kirtland immediately stopped and was never important or even interesting again.
You are, of course, referring to the phenomenon known as Mormon object permanence, meaning if LDS leaders leave a place, it ceased to exist, just like when you take a binky away from a baby. Bye, binky. Once Joseph Smith leaves New York, no one else is there and it's dead. And when he leaves Kirtland, ghost town. When Brigham Young leaves Nauvoo, they put Whiteout on all maps and never speak of it again. The reality is way more complicated and far more interesting than that. Honestly, the fact that we even still have the temple is pretty amazing. Just a few days after Joseph Smith snuck out of Dodge, Lyman Sherman burned down the print shop, which had gone over into the dissenters' hands, and the temple was apparently scorched in the process because everything was pretty close. Then a few months later, a Methodist chapel nearby was burned down. This was just going to be Act One, however. Mormons soon discovered that someone had broken a window and put some coals and straw inside the Kirtland Temple.
Friend of the podcast David Howlett theorizes that this may have actually been the work of Joseph Smith loyalists who could read the handwriting on the apostate wall and didn't want to see their beloved temple also go over to the filthy dissenters. The filthy dissenters, for their part, didn't enjoy being known as filthy dissenters, so they started calling those people loyal to Joseph Smith lick skillets.
Your mom licks a skillet.
That's beside the point.
Sorry, Brian's mom. He wrote the joke, not me.
It's true. I really did. So Mr. Howlett concludes, quote, "Whatever the real affiliation of the arsonist, the temple had been transformed less than 2 years after its dedication into a space for contending parties to attempt violent acts and form judgments about the legitimacy of one group of saints over another." And see, that's a fine point, David, but we are going to have to deduct points for not using the revolving door metaphor.
July 1838 would mark a real watershed in Kirtland history. During that month, the last of several Mormon groups departed for Missouri. All told, about 1,600 people made the journey the first half of 1838, and the most important of these travelers was, undoubtedly, Herd Cheney. Wait, who's Herd Cheney?
Listen, the very fact that my ancestor hasn't made enough of an impression on you to remember his name is very troubling.
Sounds like a kind of cheese.
Let me guess, you also don't think Oliver Higley was the best worker on the Kirtland Temple?
Oh, he's definitely got my vote.
Okay, that's better.
And I just want to point out for a minute, since we brought it up earlier, your mom listens to this podcast. That's so cute.
She's a lick skillet.
And for her sake, I will say that Oliver Higley was the best worker on the Kirtland Temple.
She appreciates that.
Another important event was a revelation from Joseph Smith directed to the people staying in Kirtland to keep the temple holy and, quote, "overthrow the money changers," a not so subtle dig at the dissenters, who were seen as dudes with only dollar signs in their eyes. It's like they haven't even read the Bible. Remember, the Kirtland Safety Society was absolutely at the heart of the downfall of Mormon Kirtland, but we don't talk about Kirtland Safety Society.
Take that, money changers. Lick skillets of the world, unite! And the final July 1838 happening was a big one. A broadside published in nearby Painesville announced this. "The Mormons of Kirtland, Geauga County, Ohio, having broken up and nearly all removed to the state of Missouri, it has been thought expedient to establish an institution of learning in the place, and thus occupy buildings which would otherwise remain comparatively useless. For this purpose, the use of their large and commodious temple has been secured for 5 years from the 1st of September, 1838. Broadside was issued by the Western Reserve Teacher Seminary. In a blueprint for Nauvoo a few years later, Joseph Smith authorized his agents in the Kirtland area to see if they could at least recoup some of the massive construction costs from the Kirtland Temple.
And what's interesting is that Mormons continued to use the building too. The Elders Quorum met there for still another year. Things just sort of hung out until early 1839 when Joseph Smith escaped from jail and relocated with his dudes to Illinois. And as things settled down, he appointed Oliver Granger as his agent in Kirtland. And this would have been very hilarious for Granger because he was already butt deep in Kirtland craziness by this point. Remember when we talked about Grandison Newell 1,000 years ago? He was a prominent dude in the Kirtland area and was not super happy about Joseph Smith just rolling into town and stealing the spotlight again. But more importantly, the green out of his wallet. At this point, there really wasn't any money. There wasn't any green yet, more like gold. And then he accused Joseph Smith of trying to have him whacked.
All right, put Grandison Newell and Oliver Granger on your shelf for just a second. No, not that shelf, smart guy. So in 1838, a guy named Samuel Rounds sued Joseph Smith and basically everyone else with a pulse in Kirtland over the Safety Society fiasco. The judge ruled in favor of Rounds, and then half of his judgment went to Grandison Newell. You can take him back down off your shelf now. Rounds had basically been Newell's proxy for the lawsuit. He just kind of filed it on his behalf. Grandison then looked Oliver Granger, along with William Marks, as agents of Joseph Smith for payment. And they did, but they apparently forgot to tell the court that they had paid him. Now, and I apologize in advance, I'm going to have to ask you to put Grandison Newell back on your shelf. I know. I can already hear your therapist giving me the business. See, most states have statutes in place that prevent shelf items being brought down and then put back again. I'm sorry. Utah does not have one of these statutes. I'm within my rights.
We really do like to keep stacking up those shelves. Oliver Granger, who you may also take down off the shelf, kept things running smooth, just like Tunex would have wanted. In 1839, wave two of the British missionaries, including my two favorite elders, Brigham Young and Heber Kimball, passed through Kirtland and even preached there. But that was a fun day. I'm sure every little girl left in Kirtland wished on the first star that she could just listen to Heber. Just one last time. They also anointed John Taylor while in town, so that's something.
Ma'am, Marianne swore she would cut you if you didn't mention that Theodore Turley was also washed and anointed during this pit stop.
Oh, I'm sorry. Was that to prepare him for getting handsy on the boat coming back?
Oof. You said that, not me. My apologies, Marianne.
Wait, didn't the teacher seminary complain about Brigham's smell encroaching on their leased territory in the temple? Because they should have. Well, no, they didn't, since they already had left. Lucky them. Turns out, though, in a pre-central heating and pre-electric blanket era, heating the whole ass building with fires was kind of expensive and difficult and messy, especially in the wintertime, which is in a definitely not pre-farming era, was exactly when you wanted to use the building.
Mormons still in Kirtland were feeling pretty good. Life had calmed down, they weren't being too loud, and HQ over in Quincy, Illinois, passed a resolution encouraging people to gather to Kirtland and build up a stake there. Since Illinois wasn't very fun yet, there were rumors that some of the people there were tempted to just come back to Kirtland. Unlike Missouri, which had been sucky pretty much the whole time, Kirtland had actually been pretty rad, especially around the temple dedication apex. But there was a problem, though. Messaging from Mormon leaders on where Kirtland stood was kind of like a
revolving door.
Damn it. Lindsay, you're stealing all of my thunders. Back in the swampy bog of Nauvoo, and P.S., don't listen to anyone who tells you Nauvoo is Hebrew for pleasant. You can tell them to shut it. I did Hebrew in the Louis Zucker room, and Nauvoo is Hebrew for swampy-ass Mosquitoville.
Did you really do it? Is it named after Louis Zucker? Juanita's Louis Zucker?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's fun.
I like Mr. Zucker.
Stay tuned for more of that in my forthcoming book about Juanita, which I have finished.
P.S. We got his copy of the John D. Lee biography. The first edition. Inscribed from her.
Is it still there?
No, it sold long ago.
Don't dangle those carrots. Those pretty cool sugar beets in front of me.
Of all the people to be inscribed to, that was very fun. Anyway, back in Swampy Bog, Joseph is buying land. All of the land.
I'm sure they were vetting the titles to this land very carefully.
Listen, I am the honorary president of the Isaac Gallen Family Association. I'm going to have to ask you to cease and desist. They had top men working on it. Top men. All of that shiny land was not a United Order thing, however. There were some big city contracts for this land, and it will require a lot of green.
No, gold.
Wait, is that where they got the idea for green and gold balls?
I do not believe so, no.
Fine. This rampant need for gold quickly makes the door for Kirtland revolve again. By the end of 1839, a first presidency letter is issued. And do you think Christina is cool if I call it a papal bull?
She just messaged me a frowny emoji with two thunderbolts, so I'm guessing that's a no.
Boo. Well, this letter told everybody in the name of the Lord not to even think about moving to Kirtland. And wait, aren't we still in the same calendar year where we were encouraging people to move to Kirtland?
Geez, I guess that's why they call it the revolving door.
Get your own metaphor, you Jezebel. Well, people kept gathering to Kirtland. There was a group of Brits that couldn't quite make it to Nauvoo before the winter, and that really boosted the numbers there. By this point, there are several hundred Mormons living in Kirtland, and that starts to spook Nauvoo. So they disfellowshipped Almon Babbitt, who is now in charge. Oh yeah, that guy. Nothing good ever happens when Almon Babbitt is in town. He always screws things up. Just ask John Bernheisel. Hiram Smith really got after the Kirtlanders. He told them to get their butts down to Nauvoo, saying, "This is thus saith the Lord." The Kirtland dudes protested, and the leaders in Nauvoo relented somewhat, telling them, "You know what? You've actually put in a lot of work there. You got a lot of infrastructure in place. You might as well just keep going." But they warned them ominously, quote, "Do not suffer yourselves to harbor the idea that Kirtland will rise on the ruins of Nauvoo." Oh, yeah, and they also threatened this vague nebulous scourge that would come. And so help me, if you say this sounds like a revolving door.
By this point, it really starts to seem like a revolving door.
Unbelievable.
A directive from Nauvoo also did away with any stakes not named Nauvoo. That was the beginning of the end for Kirtland 2.0. Our friends Kristen and Locke Mackay make a very good point as to why this happened when it did. One of the big projects in early Nauvoo was to try and get federal relief for Missouri. When Mormons realized the government was only going to send one huge box of thoughts and prayers, church leaders settled on land speculation as the only route to pay off these massive land purchases that they had made.
The confusion continued. Kirtlanders welcomed Lyman White twice over the next 2 years. During the first visit, he confidently told the gathered Mormons that they were not to leave until they were instructed by revelation. Then, in 1843, he said, here's the revelation. Oh, whoops, did I not mention that last time I was here? My bad. My apostolic bad. Well, that was it. The conference voted to peace out and started packing up. Mr. Francis Craig and his bones.
It's now June 1844. You might remember that date. Kind of important in Mormon history. Brigham Young is heading east on the Joseph Smith for President tour. There's a hint. What was that campaign slogan again?
Tip a canoe and gazelum too?
No.
In your heart, you know he's Barack Ale? Make Olaha Shinaha great again?
It's not important. Anyway, Brigham makes a stop in Kirtland and preaches in the temple again. Of course, by the end of the month, it would all change forever. Rev up the door now and let the chaos begin.
In April 1845, they held a conference in the temple, and the minutes noted that they were more united than they had been for a while.
Oh, had something happened there? Something light and fruity with notes of, I don't know, succession crisis?
Yes, 1,000% this. Sidney Rigdon had preached in the temple in February and apparently converted a decent chunk of the Mormons left in town. But it gets better, because it was the Sidney Rigdon experience featuring William Law and William McClellan.
The two Williams!
It was basically a panel of never Brighamers. And
say that three times in a mirror and guess what happens? We won't tell you. You just need to find out. Never Brighamers.
Brigham's appendix turns orange.
The whiskey is involved. I will say that much.
You might be guessing that all of this was causing Brigham to pace the floor back in Nauvoo muttering about fly turds and skins of farts. You'd be correct. Reuben McBride is now the local agent on the ground in Kirtland, and Brigham is monitoring things with a special interest in making sure the temple was safe. McBride wrote back that no one was getting all litigious about the temple. We would add, yet, so, you know, stick that up on your crowded shelf for a minute.
Reports grew increasingly tense. Jacob Bump. God, these guys' names in Kirtland, so fun. Jacob Bump, a longtime member who was also an early adopter of the Brigham Had No Game position, so it's cool, he can hang, apparently had broken into the temple and taken physical possession like a pirate. Jacob Bump sounds like a funk band, a lead singer, and a pirate that takes over the temple. Agents for the Brighamites filed a legal motion to get possession of the keys and locks back. So a sheriff gets involved. He tries, but to no avail. It was a writ of replevin for the John Dingers in the back. Will you explain what that is? John Dinger? Where are you? If I say your name in the mirror three times, will you explain to us what a writ of replevin is? The temple would stay with Jacob Bump and a few others over the next couple years, and they eventually decided to align themselves with the imperial primate himself, Mr. James Strang. In his official organ, God damn it, this is where you did it. Wait, you're not doing this again. I refuse to use that word. Brian already knows I'm loopy when we record these, and he's trying to make me get even loopier. Not gonna do it, Brian. In his periodical, The Voorhees Herald, Strang claimed, quote, "The saints in Kirtland are in full legal and peaceable possession of the temple of God in that place. They hold it by legal title. The usurpers have brought a suit against them, and after preparing the cause of trial, they withdrew the suit and paid up the cost, leaving the true church in possession of the temple." Dun dun dun.
Just thought I'd set you straight.
This might be a good time to, I hate to do this again, but maybe put everything up on the shelf while we back up just a bit to figure out, as the period of real chaos is beginning, who actually owned the Kirtland Temple.
My shelf is already too heavy. It's got all Paul Toscano's books on there.
Those are little books. Those don't weigh that much.
Heavy in thought.
It's the exoneration of Joseph and Emma that's weighing it down, isn't it? I know how shelves work. Well, to figure out who owns the temple, we need to back up to the previous century. In 1799, the Connecticut Land Company grants this giant swath of land to a group that involved a guy named Turhand Kirtland. We're going to let's stop for a minute so you can sit with your disappointment in learning that Kirtland was named for a dude named Turhand. And he didn't even go there. We'll sit with you in that. In 1827, Mr. Kirtland transfers 50 acres, including where the temple would later be, to Peter French.
These names, they're fantastic.
Turhand Kirtland, for the win.
They all sound like they could be pirates on the ship.
The old ship of Zion. 6 years later, the Mormons are now in town. Peter French sells his 100-acre farm, including all of that earlier portion, to Mormon Joseph Coe. He and another guy, Ezra Thayer, were tabbed in a council of the high priests and elders to be in charge of raising money for the land. The temple site then goes from Joseph Coe to Newell K. Whitney and Company.
The next step is a little confusing because it went from John Johnson to Joseph Smith and his, quote, successors in the office of presidency of the aforesaid church. John Johnson had contributed most of the purchase price when they bought it from Peter French, and that's why he felt like he was in on part of the deal. And that doesn't mean anything legally, of course, because it wasn't in his name. In 1836, Newell Whitney and Elizabeth Ann Smith conveyed the property to John Johnson. And so for those keeping score, this is 2 years after Johnson transferred it to Joseph Smith. Also, it had gone to Newell Whitney and Company before, with no wife involved. Kind of weird, but seems like the retroactiveness wasn't all that unusual during the time, and it was apparently totally legal and makes the original transfer kosher. Man, it was a wild time to do paperwork back then. I hear someone in the back asking, does this kind of move have a wonky name? Well, of course it does. This type of deal is not even something the ghost of John Dinger can explain. It's called estoppel by deed. Estoppel. What language is that?
Bulgarian.
There's a legal precedent, and you can fight John Dinger in the parking lot later if you want, if only he would appear and tell us what that means.
So we've kind of got a details kink going on right now. Here's a little wrinkle in that. The church was unincorporated in Ohio at this point, so it couldn't legally hold property. That's why the land goes to Joseph Smith as kind of a de facto trustee. Churches were actually restricted from holding very much property anyway, so this wasn't a bad move. Then, in 1837, John Johnson conveys the property again to Joseph Smith, and this was actually unnecessary thanks to that fancy estoppel retroactive move earlier. This time, the transfer goes solely to Joseph Smith as an individual dude, no successors, no one else mentioned. Then, just a few months later, it goes to William Marks, who was a high counselor at that time. 1837. Seem to remember this was a tense time in Kirtland. Kind of a lot happening. Kim Loving did an article on the fascinating and complicated history of ownership, and he put it pretty bluntly, quote, "Some have euphemistically characterized these conveyances as an effort to protect the assets. Lawyers might more aptly describe the transfers as a fraud upon creditors.
Well, he said the thing. In 1841, William Marks did what was known in the legal community as a givesy-backsy. I don't need John Dinger for that one. Transferring it again to Joseph Smith as sole trustee in trust. Does this sound complicated? But you can still understand it, right? Congratulations. If you can, you may have a career as a real estate lawyer. And for the rest of you, you may be entitled to compensation. We now invite you to take everything from before back down off the shelf. Thank goodness. It was getting so, so heavy with all of that Kirtland paper. Except Grandison Newell. He can continue gathering dust up there until he rots in hell. In 1845, William Marks quitclaimed everything, which included the Kirtland Temple, to Newell Whitney and George Miller, who were acting as the trustees in trust for the church and their successors. And hold that thought for a minute.
A year later, a different set of dudes, including the old suckbag himself, Alman Babbitt, who were being the trustees at that point, conveyed the temple property to Reuben McBride, the guy who was keeping an eye on things for Brigham Young. There. Do you feel that? That's the feeling of being back where we started. You know how it was when you were a kid, when you come back to the same page in a choose-your-own-adventure, you're like, I was there before. I remember this. This particular transaction was for $10,000, and as a result, Alman Babbitt apparently brags to folks that he had sold the temple. Reuben McBride then turns around and conveys it to a dude in Nauvoo named George Edmonds. Edmonds was acting as Emma Smith's lawyer in this giant mess of figuring out Joseph Smith's estate. Specifically, they're trying to figure out which hat does everything wear. Is this property Joseph Smith's, the dude, or Joseph Smith's, the trustee for the church? Even if it was for Joseph Smith, the dude, did that mean that legally he abides? Same thing went for all the debts. And there's allegations on both sides of the estate, basically saying that each side was trying to argue that more of the property was wearing one hat, while the debts were wearing the suckier hat. I know I read one journal that clearly stated the good hat was red and the sucky hat was blue. I don't know what that means, though.
Someone's going to leave an Apple review about that. Finally, George Edmonds then conveyed it back to the trustees. The problem with that path is, if William Marks had conveyed it to Joseph Smith way back in 1841, then all this subsequent nonsense after 1845 was worthless. You can't do a quit claim essentially saying, here, you can have everything if you already gave it away. And I love quitclaim. It sounds like yaging, you know, the 1838 equivalent.
That's it. I quitclaim this Facebook group.
I'm quitclaiming the temple. Also, it seems like Mormon leaders were looking at Illinois statutes relating to property and acting like Ohio worked the same. And so the moral of the story is that this strand of title is totally junk. There is one last option for title to this property, but it's still, you guessed it, up on your shelf. Just to summarize, at his death in 1844, Joseph Smith had two claims to the Kirtland Temple property. Number one, as president of the church with his successors, and this is based on that 1834 transfer from John Johnson. Or number two, the trustee in trust for the church, and this is based on the 1841 transfer from William Marks.
I realize there's a lot of names, there's a lot of dates here. It's super complicated. Hopefully this makes sense. You may want to listen to that part again. And you may be thinking to yourself, wait just a darn minute here, because these two have yakked so much legal yak, and I haven't heard word one about Mr. James Strang having the title. Yeah, there's a reason for that. Nobody who has researched and written about this mentions him, other than that thing from Strang where he says, yeah, we've got the title, and we won a lawsuit. Kim Loving, who did extensive research in the trenches of all this title abstracting, doesn't even hint at Strang. And given how creative Strang's version of his relationship to Joseph Smith was, my sense is that he is taking literary license here also. I think the legal situation was just very murky, and Strang knew that phrase and his successors and ran with it since, you know, he saw himself as Joseph Smith's successor.
Letter of appointment for the win. Well, like most things Strang, his reign in Kirtland didn't last long. The Mormons in Kirtland were not happy about the rise of, let's say, morally meh characters like John C. Bennett and William Smith in Strang's orbit. I wouldn't say morally meh. I would say, like, morally sus. What are the kids saying these days?
Ooh, yeah. Morally sus.
He's morally sus.
Super sus.
Yeah.
No cap.
By the end of 1846, they had entirely broken with Strang, and notice there's no further mention of legal title to anything in Kirtland with reference to Strang, and I feel like that's pretty telling. After they move on from Strang, William McClellan becomes the next contestant on the stage. Like, what would happen on loop during the next decade? His tenure wouldn't last very long. Mama, take this badge off of me. I can't use it anymore. It's getting dark, too dark to see.
The revolving door in Kirtland really speeds up at this point. James Brewster built up a small branch in the area and would periodically meet in the temple, but nothing really stuck. Francis Bishop, who was immortalized on my shirt today, did a similar routine. Even a couple Brighamite missionaries tried to reclaim a few people, but didn't have any luck either. Martin Harris came back on the scene at this point, pulled together a reunion tour with William Smith and a few other guys in 1855, and they held a conference in the temple. They just figured, you know what, let's just save our energy, let's just not even bother starting a church. Then eventually, William Smith tries to strong-arm his way into leadership, but didn't work. Imagine that.
Then, in 1860, we get one of the most interesting meetings in Kirtland Temple history. No, there were no Bowie knives, smart guy. If you're really on top of your game, that year, 1860, will ding a bell in the back of your head. This is because, after several years of fits and starts, the reorganization had finally happened. A coalition had prevailed on young Joseph Smith III, to lead a formal movement that would coalesce the Midwest Mormons, the Never Brighamers. I love that name. You gotta make it on a shirt now. As part of this movement, two freshly minted RLDS missionaries came to Kirtland and wanted to hold a meeting in the temple. This was historic enough on its own, but they weren't alone. You also had a dude representing the Brighamites and Martin Harris and Leonard Rich for their local Church of Christ. And now don't get too excited about the Church of Martin. It was apparently a grand total of 7 people, but, and this is actually important, among Martin's church, meager assets were the keys to the temple. We're still in the keys are 9/10 of the law phase in Kirtland Town. The grand total of 7 people. It sounds like they were the first independents. Isn't that like the Darkers? Like 7 dudes?
It cracked me up. The record of the description of it said, and 4 of them were women. So, yeah, only 3 really counted anyways. All right, folks, here we go. It's about to get even sexier. So the Brighamite dude spoke for a few minutes, nothing super memorable. Nothing about shit on Congress or something that Brigham could have really gotten behind. Then Leonard Rich gets up, starts talking. All of a sudden, the audience watches as a dude in the congregation hops up on the partition in the middle of the room. And if you've ever been to the Kirtland Temple in the meeting room there on the first floor, you can totally picture this happening. Guy walks on the partition up to the front, quote, stamping, hissing, and making other violent demonstrations. Wow, with a demonstration like that, I sure hope he has a memorable name.
He would not disappoint. This was the one, the only, Increase Van Dusen. Yes, his name is Increase Van Dusen. And this is another one of those moments that will determine whether you truly deserve the nerd hat, because he's come up only once before. Well, technically twice, because we mentioned that he had written the first expose of the endowment. That, however, was the tangent to the real story where, since he was suspicious that James Strang was a polygamist, because he was, Van Dusen got up in a meeting screaming, "You are guilty!" and then tried to punch Strang. I love this story so much. I think about it every time I'm sitting in the Kirtland Temple. I think about it every time.
Yeah, it seems like there's a pattern going on with this guy. So Van Dusen then climbs up to the highest pulpit and swings his coat around his head until it rips to shreds. Still stamping, hissing, and screaming, for the record.
And they didn't even have meth back then.
The best part, though, is he then preaches in the temple several times over the coming weeks. I mean, as attention-getting exercises go, that's pretty tough to top.
And this was all going on against the backdrop of the return of Grandison Newell. Listeners, you've been so patient, so you get a treat. You can take your hands, put them up there, take little Grandison Newell back down, take him off your shelf. To recap, his role in all of this, when Samuel Rounds had sued Joseph Smith and Company back in 1837 over the Safety Society debacle, it was Grandison driving the bus. Even though he had been paid his part of the judgment, and actually double since he took the part intended for the state of Ohio, Newell talked the state legislature into resurrecting the judgment against Joseph Smith. He convinced them that the judgment should be assigned to him, claiming a bunch of court costs to boot. And all of this seems to be pretty bogus.
Part of this whole process was they needed an administrator for Joseph Smith's estate. And this part is great. Grandison Newell manages to get his wife's grandpa named to the post. Grandpa, of course, had no connection to any of this. A key part of their attack plan was to argue that Joseph Smith owned the Temple property by virtue of the 1837 transfer from John Johnson. This was not a coincidence. That was the transaction that named Joseph Smith the individual. As we've discussed, thanks to that fancy legal footwork with the retroactive estoppel, that 1837 deal was mostly imaginary. And just as an aside, Grandpa told Grandison to raise the Kirtland Temple and then sell the stones to make money. I think we can all agree that Grandpa can go to the bad place for that very scary idea.
Whatever. The wheels of justice were moving, even if they really shouldn't have been. The administrator printed a notice alerting Emma and family that stuff was going to be sold to satisfy the supposed debts to Grandison Newell. Appraisers decided that the temple property was valued at $325. Yeah, you heard that right. At auction, William Perkins paid the absolute minimum, $217, and walked off as the new owner.
This whole thing reminds me of the Simpsons episode where Bart buys the warehouse for like a dollar. Hey, look at me. I own a warehouse now.
I know. I was
$200 and he got the temple.
I was thinking $200. Like, what was the last thing I spent $200? Probably on Amazon. Batteries for my kids' remote controls. Like, $200 for the temple. So, yeah, William Perkins walks away, new owner, except he was using the resurrected judgment against Joseph Smith's estate as sort of credit, and so exactly $0 left his wallet. So Perkins then turned around and immediately sold it to Russell Huntley for $150. Just keeps getting cheaper. Huntley had been homies with Zadok Brooks, which is another name, who, along with Martin Harris, sometimes, ran the massive seven-person Church of Christ we mentioned earlier. If it's got an altar in the home, it counts. Steve Shields will mark it, so we're good.
Oh, it's an entity, absolutely. Now, to Russell Huntley's credit, he actually loved the temple. He had already spent a lot of time and money fixing up even before he owned it, and it needed it. You get these periodic reports indicating people took the letters off the pulpits, they would carve their name in it, and it was just kind of getting run down. A few years later, Huntley moved to Illinois, and got to know Joseph Smith III, and eventually sold him the property for $150. And this time, he did it by quitclaim, which was kind of demonstrating that they all knew the title was very murky, and it was just kind of a do-over.
This part may be a little surprising to many folks, but Joseph Smith III only wanted to sell the temple to pay off his own debts. His partner in the purchase was Mark Forcecut, a guy who had been LDS but bailed over polygamy. He also was in debt and felt like this was their golden goose, and so by 1875, they had a prospective deal with the town of Kirtland for $2,500. It's gone up just a bit. At the 11th hour, the town discovered that all that the Smith and Forcecuts were holding was a quitclaim deed. Not again a quitclaim. Not exactly the most reassuring form of ownership.
At this point, Joseph Smith III goes to the presiding bishopric and asks for a quitclaim deed from the church in order to kind of muscle that sale through. And this is just another one of those reminders that the RLDS church is so different, because the presiding bishop tells Joseph Smith III, the prophet president of the church, no dice, buddy. His position was Russell Huntley never actually had a clear title, and he wasn't wrong. More importantly, he thought that the temple belonged to the church, not to Smith and Forcecut as individuals. And can you even imagine this in an LDS context? The presiding bishop telling Brigham Young to sit down and shut up?
Yeah, I can imagine, and I think about it all the time.
And let's be honest, the bishop's arguments were very solid. And the bishop then turns all this back on Smith, telling him that he and Mark Forcecut needed to deed the temple to the church. Again, very different from how things worked in Utah.
It proceeded in a very rational, common-sense way. The church appointed a committee to look into it. A big part of that was getting a lawyer to figure out an abstract of title, tracking each transfer over the past 40 years. Sure would have been nice to have had that guy here today. Just saying. Took forever to get this done because the abstractor wanted $20 in advance and they didn't have it. And after dude in his green visor finished the project, Smith concluded that the title probably was in the church's hands and, great news, he and Forskett didn't need to pay taxes anymore. Seems at least mildly convenient. Everyone by this point agreed that formal, legal action was going to be needed to get the title mess cleared up. Just for kicks, throughout this period, uncertainty was the central vibe. Random little groups popped up and used the temple for 5 minutes and then rode off into the sunset. LDS missionary Edward Stevenson preached there twice. The second time when he came out to grab Martin Harris and hustle him off to Utah, and ever the loyal Utah, his sermon topic was Brigham Young, the true successor to the prophet Joseph Smith. Atta boy, that's a bold move. Go back to temple and just, you know, mark your territory.
Apparently they had sort of a visitor logbook, and next to his name they put that the local RLDS elders yelled at him and did not support his sermon.
They yelled at him in the temple, back when going to the temple was fun.
You had a military group that held a reunion there. There was a Mr. Miners organization. Maybe a Bingham High alumni group. Nobody knows. An RLDS guy finally got some momentum going. He had a branch of about 30 people build up. Then the ladies got all riled up at him for something. Joseph Smith III's advice to him? Dude, just resign and move somewhere else. And he did exactly that. On the way out of town, he dropped off the keys with Sister Dayton, and now she was in charge.
They gave it to a woman?
Maybe she was one of the four women in the Church of Christ.
By 1879, it was time to get litigious. The RLDS Church filed a complaint naming anyone and everyone who might feel like they had a claim on the temple. A guy who had bought part of the property, but not the part where the temple stood. A lady who had bought another little sliver of the land. The LDS Church, of which John Taylor is president. And just to cover their bases, John Taylor as an individual. What about the people that, like, crushed up their china and put it in the walls? Do they get a
best
piece?
China that they bought at Costco in
some
Kirkland?
Of you may be
that some people call Kirkland
entitled to compensation. So their basic claim was that RLDS Church was the true and in fact only lawful and legitimate successor of the church, organized and established by Joseph Smith on the 6th day of April, AD 1830. What is interesting is that they could have just waited a few more years. After 21 years following the probate sale, i.e. 1883, the title would basically be clean as a whistle. However, they didn't want to wait any longer. You never know when the ghost of Brigham Young would come knocking. Sunny and the fish are sure to find. Boys down on the corner's got a poker game tonight. But I can't do neither one, they'll have to understand. Gotta bring home the bacon, cause I'm a family man.
A big part of this, even if they never said the quiet part out loud, was this is a killer opportunity for a judge to legally decide what they had believed all along. They, not those pliggy Brighamites out in the desert, were the legitimate descendants of Joseph Smith's church. Now, you might be tempted to wander out in the weeds while thinking, wait, Joseph Smith seemed awfully polygamous all through Nauvoo. That's a very tempting walk in the weeds because that is also 1,000% true. Say what you want about the Brighams and the Hebers of the world, but they definitely grasped Joseph's vision and ran with it, tacking on some Adam God for good measure. And this, of course, is precisely the logical crossroads where the phenomenon of polygamy denial is born, because it was super difficult for them to argue this very central point without invoking it.
The RLDS complaint required the defendants to produce their title to the property. The whole thing was more of a theoretical rather than physical case. The RLDS Church didn't name John Taylor because they wanted money from him or anything like that. It was simply to achieve the legal opinion that they were the rightful successors and therefore owners. And yes, there are Latin phrases that describe all of this. Those damn lawyers. Someone call John Dinger. Or move back to Rome if you love Latin so much.
Not surprisingly, given that the defendants probably didn't subscribe to newspapers in Ohio, none of the defendants appeared in court to contest the complaint. I don't know, maybe John Taylor did subscribe. Seems like a guy who enjoys a good newspaper. The RLDS attorney in the case, despite knowing no one on the other side would show up, knew there might be a little difficulty drawing a really nice, clear, straight line from Joseph Smith to the RLDS church, so he asked church leaders for several things and even wondered, is there like an old timer in Ohio that would come and testify so we can grease the wheels?
After examining the case for a week, the judge finally rendered his decision. It was not quite the slam dunk they'd hoped for, though. The judge basically agreed with everything that they were the legitimate successors, but there was a problem with how the RLDS church styled the case. The judge ruled the property was held by the heirs of Joseph Smith, quote, in trust for the church, not the church itself. Therefore, the church as an entity couldn't sue for possession. No worries, Joseph Smith III immediately deeded it to the RLDS Church, and that, my patient friends, is that. The RLDS Church now had solid legal title to the temple and would keep it until Russell Nelson came a knocking.
This has been such an interesting thing to watch because the second that it broke, everyone coming to Benchmark wanted to know, you know, what do you think about all this?
Well, we were calling each other too.
Yeah, I mean, we were on this.
We had like a few hour notice.
Yes. And it was interesting because from the time a few years back when a few things started being sold, it seemed like it was a matter of time. And it was very sad to watch because obviously we know so many people who have done historic sites for years. It is quite literally their life, their home. And so it was just heart-wrenching thinking how this impacted our friends. And
yeah, that's what I was thinking. Locke Mackay, I wondered how he was. For those who don't know, tell them who Locke Mackay is.
Locke's a direct descendant of Joseph Smith, a very smart man. Very patient, fantastic, very underrated sense of humor, a fantastic person, and just kind of another one of those different things, he's an apostle.
Yeah, I love that he always tells me he's descended from Emma, not Joseph. I love that. Yeah, it has been interesting, especially with this really complicated history. You can tell that there's a struggle for belonging, and it asks, the Kirtland Temple asks the question of who does Mormonism belong, and I think that to many people in this last month, they see it as the LDS. LDS dominion over all the other churches. And that's important to a lot of people that I know. And I don't like that attitude. And I felt like one of the beautiful things about the Community of Christ and the RLDS is that they understood that it was a building that meant a lot to a lot of different people and respected that. I unfortunately don't see our tradition being that way. I hope that we will be, because I know a lot of the people in the historical department that are going to be helping with this are of that mindset that this belongs to a wider group of people. But I've just interacted with too many of my own LDS friends and family who there's a smugness about it. I had family members call and tell me, you know, we're at a point where we can dialogue respectfully with each other, even though we come from different faith perspectives. And there was a smugness that the church was true. The LDS church was true. This was a sign of it. And, you know, I asked the family member because they have money. And that family member said, yeah. And it was like so tied to authority for them and trueness. So I don't know. It's tricky. It's complicated. I do appreciate that money is going to be put into the temple. Thank goodness the missionary department is not over it for the next 15 years. And so hopefully people can go see it. But I will miss the days where, you know, I got to lead a meeting in the Kirtland Temple, stand at the pulpit that was only allowed for men, you know, for so many years, and sort of take that back. And Community of Christ allowed me to have that experience. And I just hope the LDS will do that for everyone else.
We've talked about this before, but right before the world went nuts and COVID, we were in Kirtland and we did a midnight tour of the temple, basement to belfry. One of the coolest things I've ever done, sitting on the first floor, pitch black, as cars come up the hill and the headlights play through the windows across the wall. Just an unbelievable experience. Don't think that'll happen anymore.
What's sad about it is I remember, you know, we used to go to Kirtland every year for Sunstone, where, and at Nauvoo. We were planning a Nauvoo retreat this year, and we've had to change that because I know that we will not be welcome in the same way that we were welcome before. And it's such a tragedy because on one of the trips we were there, I remember leaving a Sunstone event that we had done at the Kirtland Temple, exiting, and outside were two different groups of different Mormons from different Mormon traditions. And it's a history that belongs to everyone, but especially to all these different Mormon groups. And there has to be an acknowledgement of that, that this is a sacred place for a lot of people, even people that have left the church. It's important for people to go back and process that. And, you know, Community of Christ has been such a generous host of that. And I just, again, my message is I hope that generosity persists.
Our thanks have gone out to their incredible stewardship. I mean, they stayed there. They took care of it. They cared about it. LDS Mormons did not. They left.
And the LDS people are being so smug about it online. And I realize this is not all LDS people. But like, folks, come get your people because they're being awful to Community of Christ. And I think the worst part is they don't even realize how awful it is to say something like we won, like it's a football game, you know? I that's been really interesting to watch. My own tradition, unsurprising, but interesting. And yeah, just if you're hearing out there, like stop your people from doing that. Have some compassion. And can we stop saying that the Community of Christ, since they also just hit their women's ordination anniversary, stop saying that this is why it happened, because they got woke. I mean, Community of Christ are some of the most genuinely Christ-like people that strive to be like the kind Jesus in the Bible. That's not a bad thing.
It is interesting to note that in the wake of that 1880 decision, that was trumpeted. There was a plaque in the temple that announced that a judge had legally decided they were the legitimate successors. It's an important thing to them too. But you know what? They took that down. That was not important to their identity anymore.
And for those who haven't followed the story, we'll throw up a link for that, because I think, you know, people listening in a couple of years from now, they won't understand the relevance of this. But the news has sort of shook the Mormon world, especially the historical world and the Community of Christ. And it was hard to watch in real time our Community of Christ friends learn of the thing, because we have been hearing for years that if we ever heard that they sold the church or they sold the temple to the church, it would be like, don't believe it. Because there were hoax. I'm quoted in a hoax story from 2 years ago. Ben Park sent it over. We're both quoted. Someone wrote a satire about for April Fools, and they quoted us in it. That was 2 years ago. It turns out it was kind of prophetic. I don't know what fake me said, but I'm sure it was spot on. But yeah, I'm shocked. I'm still kind of shocked and sad about it. We'll see in a couple years what it looks like. But yeah, thank you, Community of Christ. And I'm sorry that you're going through this really difficult time, because I know what these properties meant to you. Ain't cutting my head and the good Lord comes. Arrive upon the mountain just to see what you've done. Cutting my hair, cutting till the good Lord comes. I ain't over my
No, I wouldn't put you on, because it really did. It happened just this way. The day my mama socked it to Books of Mormons Report, PTA, powered by Benchmark Books. Since we talked the history of ownership, seems only fair to talk a little bit about the history of the history of ownership. So the first academic crack at this was Davis Bitten's Waning of the Mormon Kirtland in BYU Studies. It's old, so it's very heavy on history of the church and journal history, as things from that era tended to be. It was a good start, though. Next was Roger Lanius's book, The Kirtland Temple, A Historical Narrative. Since it was published by Herald House, it's kind of like a quasi-official look at things from the RLDS point of view. As always with Lanius, it's very well researched. The section on that 1880 lawsuit was particularly groundbreaking. Then, Kristen and Locke Mackay, who we talked about, have been involved with historic sites for the RLDS Church and Community of Christ for years, did an article called A Time of Transition that covered the history from 1838 to 1880. The best place to find that, of course, is in our friend Christian Larson's book, Ancient Order of Things. Then in 2004, Kim Loving published an excellent article in the Journal of Mormon History entitled Ownership of the Kirtland Temple, Legends, Lies, and Misunderstandings. And this was interesting because Loving was an active pastor in Community of Christ. He was very straightforward in what the history actually said. Sadly, he passed away just before the article was published. I would really have liked to have shaken his hand. A lot of work went into that article. A decade later, all-around solid human being David Hallett published his dissertation in book format, Kirtland Temple, The Biography of a Shared Mormon Sacred Space. He combined history with musings on the nature of what a temple means in Community of Christ context, peppered with his observations as a guide there over many years. Very thoughtful, very good. Finally, Jeff Walker, who worked on the legal series for the Joseph Smith Papers early on, wrote a lengthy article in BYU Studies, The Kirtland Safety Society and the Fraud of Grandison Newell, a Legal Examination. The main focus, obviously, is on Newell, but this bleeds into the temple history, obviously. His summary of that complicated title situation is really useful. Now, finally, another plug for the Joseph Smith Papers. At one point during this, I was stuck between two perspectives on a point because it disagreed on basic wording, and I thought, I just want to see the stupid document we're talking about. And I'm kind of embarrassed it took me a minute to remember, duh, this is Joseph Smith era, it's going to be on the paper site. Of course it's there. As usual, get these and everything else in the Mormon universe at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake or at benchmarkbooks.com.
I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young, and let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, and let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young, as an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.